Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Dugout Debate Podcast. This week, we've got a very special guest on the podcast, Evie Harrison. Hello, Evie.
Hello.
Just like me, Evie has a history in sports science, but has since branched off in a completely different direction, using sport to effect positive social change in her job. And as somebody who knows literally nothing about this side of sport, I'm going to be intrigued to hear what goes on in that world, and hopefully you will too. So, Evie, firstly, just tell us a bit about yourself, what your education was and what jobs you've been involved in since you left uni.
Okay, Tim. So like you said, I did my undergrad with yourself in the sports science kind of world. It was only through kind of running for sports officer in my third year that I realised I liked talking about sport more than I liked maybe anatomy or physiology. And I really kind of liked the social issues around sport. Hence, kind of went off, did Camp America, came back, managed to get myself onto a sports policy and business management postgrad, which was a lot more seminar based, a lot more kind of current issues in sport around maybe doping, gender, ethnicity, looking at mega events and how they kind of play into the political scene of different countries. And it was really through there I kind of got an internship with a local sports charity that use sport for kind of social change and how can we use physical activity to not just play sport to kind of address some kind of social issues, especially within kind of the major cities in the UK.
Well, that's really cool. Like, just as an aside quickly, this popped into my head as you were saying stuff then. It just is really cool how sports science has led us down such different paths. I mean, we've been friends almost since day one, but I think just generally, you get people branching off to very weird, wonderful things. For instance, I'm training as a cardiac scientist and you've gone down the sort of social route, but we've all started at the same point. I really like how it just produces lots of different people. Different things can spark different changes. But whatever, that's just an aside. Just for a bit of fun, I know you were keen on our podcast to do with our sporting heroes. I'm going to ask you for your top three. You can start at number three if you like. Just quickly, who it is and why, just a sentence or so.
Okay, my number three would be Antonio Brown. Being fairly new to NFL like yourself, I've picked up a bit of an allegiance to the Steelers and just some of the athleticism he displays is just unreal at some times. And he's just a cool guy. So, Antonio Brown would be my number three.
Well, you have a history in American football. I think you played that down a little bit. former GB player, nonetheless. So there we go. Yeah, number two.
Number two is a bit of a left of centre one. I'm going to go with Eve Muirhead, purely because yes. I am completely fixated on curling when it every Winter Olympics when it comes around, and I just think her leadership and her passion for it is just something that kind of transpires not only curling but kind of anyone that's passionate about sport. And she's Scottish, which always helps. So.
And your number one?
Number one would be Billie Jean King. Obviously, you know Tim, but I guess for the listeners, I love tennis. I'm quite heavily involved in tennis on a local level, but I'd say Billie Jean King more for her LGBTQ work. Obviously, I've recently watched Battle of the Sexes and kind of knew the story before that, but a bit of a trailblazer when it comes to obviously the WTA and setting that up, but also a massive advocate for women's rights and LGBTQ rights. So, yeah.
Yeah, 100% right. I think I threw her on sort of in my honourable mentions sort of category. Shame she didn't get on there. She got some points from me, but there we go. Right, good. So that's enough of the fun. How did you find yourself in the current field? I know you've kind of addressed this already, but how did you sort of work your way into this side specifically?
So during my internship with kind of the current sports charity I work with, I worked on a project called Women Make Coaching, which is something I'm quite passionate about, to be honest. There's not, particularly in my field, there needs to be more female role models within tennis and especially coaching. So I kind of helped support the project from that point of view, especially around the social media. As luck would have it, finishing my internship, a position came available as a kind of an entry level where I work currently, and was really a kind of get to know the sporting landscape of Birmingham and what is the city's makeup. Maybe demographically, socially, politically, economically, who are the big players? And that's something, I suppose I've always been quite interested in human geography. So that's something that was quite interesting to me. And it helps that I really like Birmingham. So here we are.
Very good. This is quite a diffuse question, granted, but okay. I'm, you know, you're not here to have an easy time. What sort of things are you most interested in the world of sport? Is it, I know obviously policy, but can you just elaborate any more on that?
I guess it takes two strands. So around getting more females into coaching is a particular interest, like my internship. But also, how can we really use sport for social change? So maybe that is getting someone just to volunteer who might necessarily not be the most sporty, but is a great people person and knows how to interact with people and how to get someone maybe involved in a session. But also around, we know the curriculum currently in schools is so restrictive and it doesn't cater for every child, every young person. So how do we use sport and physical activity to bring out the best in maybe those that get left behind in the curriculum is something that I find really interesting. And we do quite a lot of work with the on our apprenticeship scheme doing that at the minute.
Lovely. We're going to be doing quite a bit on sort of youth participation. I think that's probably really the focus of this podcast. So we'll jump back into that later. But I think we'll start with opposite end of your job. Like, what's stopping people engaging with sport at a youth level? What are the immediate barriers to sport participation in the youth?
So we did a little bit of a study around the Birmingham area where we kind of took, I think it was 750 young people in the end and kind of got them to sit down and kind of say, well, where do you find out about sessions? What's stopping you get to sessions? And one of the big barriers, Tim, was really travel. How do we make travel in the city accessible? But also, how do we make it affordable? Are sports, physical activity opportunities in the city, are they signposting where the nearest bus stop is when they're showcasing their sessions? Are they accounting for the travel time it takes for a young person to get there? But yeah, big things around cost and also family and friends. If you can have kind of family and friends that are involved or maybe want to go along, we've found that it makes a big difference as opposed to maybe turning up and doing something. Also a big factor, I've talked around cost, but if it's free, especially when you're working with people that maybe usually don't get involved in physical activity and maybe have less money in that regard, being free is always an advantage when getting people moving. But yeah, definitely that around transport and how can we make it most accessible and showcase people what opportunities are around their area.
You're definitely right. In Birmingham, just that, you know, we lived there for 5 years. It can be quite difficult to get around there, especially if you don't have access to a car. And God knows what I'd have done if I didn't have my parents being able to drop me off going to sport and that sort of thing. I probably just wouldn't have bothered. So yeah, travel is really obviously quite a big thing, but I never really considered it. So already you've enlightened me. This is a little bit off piste, but in terms of engagement with sport at schools, sort of how are you with that particular landscape at the moment? Do you think sport at schools is quite an effective means for driving participation, or do you think it's lacking?
I think it's not my area in particular, but I can kind of talk off some of the stuff we're involved in. So the school games, so that happens across all the schools in the city and is a UK thing. It's part of the 2012 legacy, the school games. It kind of instills the Olympic values within the kids that take part. I think generically, the curriculum perhaps in the past has been too restrictive in terms of traditional sports being too gendered. I think in some schools, you're starting to see a change there in terms of what their offer is. Some are beginning to offer bubble football, Zumba. It's much more, say, for instance, football is a less of a gendered thing now than it was perhaps when you and I were at school. So I think we're getting there. I think it never helps when sport is perhaps the last thing that gets thought about when it comes to maybe budgets and stuff like that. But especially things around the sugar tax. I mean, that money goes directly to primary schools that they can only spend on their physical activity kind of program and how they look to integrate that within their schools. So there's a long way to go, but there are some really interesting things out there. For instance, the Daily Mile started in Stirling in Scotland, where a head teacher said, look, the kids aren't fit enough and I'm pretty sure if I can get them active, their attainment levels will go up. She proved right, and Sport England have since invested in it, and posts are going out throughout the UK. So there's definitely case studies there where sport and schools are making a real good link. And yeah, it's always an interesting topic, shall we say.
For sure. Something you said during that actually kind of struck quite a chord with me. You said something along the lines of sport is often one of the last things to think about when you think about funding in schools. At a sort of a national sort of health level, that's the biggest joke I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. You know, the first thing you've got to be doing is getting people involved in sort of a fit and active lifestyle. And think of all the good preventative things that can do in the future. Just, you know, if you get people to love getting out, getting active, doing things, even if it's just, you know, rambling in the countryside or, you know, kicking a football once a week with your mates. Like, think how many people just sit out there and do nothing. How many people would be in such a better state now compared to what they are currently if they'd had that sort of the one PE teacher that pushed them in the right direction, or that funding there to be able to get them to training to do whatever they wanted to do, or just the access to that weird niche sport that just kept them going for life. Yeah, that, it made me angry, that, actually.
But I think we're getting there in terms, if you look at our obviously current government and the social prescription model, they're starting to look more at prevention. But I mean, we're at the brink of a, you know, you're involved in the NHS, but we are on the brink of a massive, if not already a massive, national obesity crisis. And it's, we can't look at kind of post now. We have to look at preventing. And that starts from a really early age. And it starts from how do we get kids involved in physical activity? Even if it's such the physical activity in the loosest term, how do we get people moving as a society, I think is a real poignant point. 100%.
Because the difficult thing is, this is completely off where we were going with the questions that I initially said, but, you know, why not? I think some of the difficulty comes when you say to people, look, you're in this state, let's say, you know, you're a bit overweight and you don't really do much in terms of sport. When they're already at that stage, getting them off the sofa and doing stuff is really difficult. If you take the onus early and get it as part of their everyday life, then that you're sort of future-proofed, if you like. Do you see along those lines, or do you see it a bit differently?
I do. I do think sustainable travel's got a part to play, and I think Sustrand and organisations like that are very vocal in that. But you're completely right. We have to move away from this sport for sport's sake, and maybe getting those Olympic medals and the focus on that, as to how do we put physical activity in our daily lives and make sure people are moving? You look at other cities, you look at Seville, you look at Copenhagen, their cycling system is second to none. And it's kind of, it isn't a car city. Everyone moves. It's just a way of life. So it's really kind of embedding that sport by stealth model, I guess.
Yeah. So you said Sustrans, just explain what that is. Sustainable transport.
Yeah, you got it in one. So they work across the UK, looking at cycling routes, looking at sustainable transport.
Lovely. Right, so we addressed that a little bit there. I think we started to. But how can sport be used as a tool for positive change in underprivileged areas?
Part of the work I do at the minute, we identified three areas across the city that perhaps have particular high levels of youth joblessness, lack of attainment, that kind of thing. So we essentially take a bit of a sport by stealth model, and we physically have a van, and we go out and we do quite a lot of outreach work to kids that maybe just bumping about the place at the minute and not particularly doing much. And it's kind of that, well, if we can use sport as the hook and we can get them involved in doing something positive and getting a bit more of a positive outlook in the future, who knows where they might go on to. So yes, we do sport in those sessions, but we also do roundtable discussions on current kind of issues, maybe within in the papers, that kind of thing. And we also do a bit of CV workshops and music production. So it's far more than sport. And that's just a little bit of a sample of how we can positively use sport by stealth as a means to get young people engaged.
Okay, so you're trying to use sport as a mediator to allow them to come and do other things with you, essentially. So you using sport as a draw and somewhere where you can then go off to different topics and help them in other ways. Is that sort of the right branch, or am I getting that wrong?
Yeah, so I think sport provides that kind of a bit of a common thread through people, I guess. There's particularly in this day and age, we like to mention our differences, don't we? But sport is kind of common through a lot of people. And even if maybe perhaps you're not the sportiest, you maybe support a team, a football team, or it kind of provides that kind of secondary sub theme maybe to a conversation. So I've mentioned sport by stealth quite a lot. It's kind of that, well, if we can get people in the same room and we can get them all talking about maybe something they're passionate about, and we can get them then building on that idea, how do we then, we've got them there kind of captive almost, how do we then feed sport into that mix and really get them positive, enjoying kind of the benefits of sport whilst talking about how the local history is so great or something of that guys.
Okay, so you're not necessarily just going out and kicking a ball around with kids, you're actually using that to facilitate doing other things. So I know I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but I'm just trying to get my head around it, because what I assumed you did was what I said previously, just going out kicking a ball with kids and then just having a bit of fun with them and then getting them sort of active and healthy. But I'm wrong, clearly.
No, so yeah, part of it, we will go and we will set up a activity and it will be sport-based. And say, for instance, whatever conversations come out of that, our youth workers that are involved in the sport will pick up on that and build. But so that is the kind of engagement side, I guess. Another strand is the volunteer side. So like I said, we've had quite a few different mega events, minor mega events in Birmingham this year, i.e. the World Indoor Athletics. And quite a big thing there we were focused on as a organisation were, how do we get Brummies involved in the event? So how do we get people that are really person-centred but know the city? So if anyone comes to them, they can recommend a fantastic restaurant. They know where everything is. And it's so they will then have that experience. And perhaps that will prick their interest into maybe going into something in sport, maybe a career in sport. Maybe they'll want to volunteer at another slightly higher mega event. But it's all kind of around that social return element, I guess.
This is really interesting. It's a lot more multifaceted than I sort of imagined. This is just ignorance on my behalf. So you're getting people to engage in sport and then getting them to socially engage in sport, which means they're more likely to come back and work to help mm-hmm. other people socially engage in sport. That's complicated, but it's really interesting. So in terms of the people that actually go out there and do things on the front line, stop me if this is not an area that you can really talk about. What are the jobs that people are actually doing out there in the community in a sport, under a sport bracket, if you see what I'm saying?
Okay, so we have a project that's been 3-year funded. Like I said, it happens in 3 areas of the city. And those people that go out there and engage with young people are youth engagement officers. Quite often they'll have a background maybe in youth work or predominantly maybe a little bit of sport. Usually kind of multi-sport. Some of them are maybe from that area, so they kind of understand what people's needs are, understand what maybe they want. But yeah, that's kind of our engagement branch, those kind of guys.
So I'm building off the back of that. What is the current state of youth engagement in sport currently, and in Birmingham, obviously?
So we've got a range of organisations working in Birmingham around young people. So obviously you have schools is one side and PE teachers and that kind of branch, but you also have a few organisations that are working with maybe NEET young kids, so that's young people that aren't in any formal education. You have local organisations that are maybe working within their community group within the different areas of Birmingham, and you also have maybe slightly larger organisations that potentially look at kind of BME communities. And yeah, so there's a real variety of kind of sports landscape in Birmingham, I guess. And that is something that's quite hard to capture of sorts in terms of numbers. One of the main things that captures participation is the Active Life Survey that Sport England do kind of every couple of months. And that kind of looks at people that are active, fairly active and inactive. So we actually saw a little rise in those that were fairly active, I believe, this time around. But it's also quite hard to gauge from that because the sample size isn't as big as we'd perhaps want it to.
Just jumping straight in on that, sorry. What are they doing? Are they sending surveys out to people's houses and they just fill them out and send them back in?
I believe it's a mix. Don't Don't quote me on this because I don't know. I believe it's a mix of telephone calls and going out and seeing people face to face.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I interrupted.
It's all right. That tells us a little bit of a picture, but isn't the biggest sample size. So quite a lot of the work we tend to do, I guess, is on our own projects, measuring what numbers we are getting through, but also measuring the kind of the wider, I guess, qualitative info, if you will, if you were to put it in that kind of guise.
So at a national level, who sort of dictates these kind of engagement policies? Is it Sport England? I'm really unaware of that sort of landscape.
Yes.
Whose remit do you fall under is essentially the question I'm asking.
So we are partially funded by Sport England. So there are, best way I can describe it, Sport England are the body for grassroots sport in England. They have 44 active partnerships that sit under them, and that they focus on different geographical areas. And quite a lot of the, we will get a chunk of money to deliver kind of Sport England strategy that's been set out.
And we're going to move in a slightly different direction now. Chris and I, as you know, we really loved the 2012 London Olympics. We just got so much hype off the back of that, and I think the whole nation did. There was a lot of talk in the build-up to it about the legacy that it was going to have and how it was going to inspire a new generation of youthy, sporty people doing all these things and then going on to win further gold medals. And I know that this is actually not necessarily the goal of a sport to go out and win medals and that sort of thing. It's just to get people up and active and all that sort of thing. But do you think the Olympics has affected youth engagement in sport as far as you can tell?
It's an interesting one to try and quantify. Like I previously said, the school games is something that came out of 2012. So that happens every year with primary and secondary schools. And that is schools will do in-house competition. Then they'll do perhaps inter area, and then they'll do kind of city. And then if they're the best of their city, they will go to a national one. And that's kind of competitive sport, but kind of founded on those principles of Olympism and off the back of 2012. There is a number of projects, and as everything has a lifespan, it's a few of them have now finished, and you're kind of looking at different funding cycles. But definitely, I can't obviously comment on the London area, but there has been some kind of programmes from 2012, some bits of funding that is kind of key to any sort of legacy when we talk about mega events. Obviously, we have the feel-good factor at the time, you know, England in the World Cup in the summer, but how do we build on that? So that's the kind of shop window, but behind the scenes, how we grow in our business, to put it in quite a businessy fashion, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure like that sort of prep is something that most people don't think about, I'm guessing. I certainly wouldn't do like in the build up to the Olympics, because I would just think, oh, you know, people get that Olympic vibe and just go out and play a bit of sport afterwards. But I'm sure like obviously you could probably attest to this, and that, you know, you need a lot of prep beforehand to be able to take advantage of it afterwards. In terms of you personally, what do you think the Olympic legacy has been, and whether or not it's actually helped the UK social sporting landscape?
I think in terms of 2012, it's quite an interesting legacy. You look at the programmes I've just mentioned, like Spirit of 2012, school games, from that kind of social sport legacy aspect. But then I guess a lot of it is around what has 2012 left behind physically. So we look at kind of West Ham's ground, and we look around the stories of kind of the taxpayer footing the bill. And that's quite an interesting one from my perspective. We look at the athlete villages that quite a lot of them got bought by Middle Eastern companies and sold for mega bucks. So it's really quite multifaceted, I guess, the legacy. And I know when I look back on it personally, 2012 was amazing. But it's kind of that sustainability. Quite a lot of our facilities have been maintained and have become obviously training centres for national athletes. But in terms of the wider area, that kind of the Westfields area that was to come out of 2012. It's really quite an interesting, not ups and downs, I'd say, but how maybe different elements of 2012 have panned out.
Yeah, it's an interesting debate to have this, I think. We'll stick on it for a second because a couple of things jumped into my head while we're chatting. The first thing I'll say is that I live in London and I know that area quite well. And it just seems that it's a big elephant of underused space. And whilst this is not a problem just with London, this happens in every Olympic city around the world. You know, you basically build something with a specific focus and then that focus goes away and you just have it sat there. But you really would have thought that, okay, we're not just going to foot the bill for West Ham to come and play in our stadium, essentially. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do other stuff with it, drive, a lot more stuff to that other end of London. Because Wembley gets blinking loads of money from, you know, the NFL hosted there, you know, call it this, that and the other from rugby league and all that sort of stuff. I know that the Olympic Stadium doesn't have quite the same kudos as Wembley. But why aren't we using that at the same level? You know, that is a good enough stadium. It could be repurposed and redesigned. It's not great for any football club to be in that stadium. Why are we using it for that? That's the first thing. But I also do see, you know, the other side of it, not being able to actively use something which is for a very specific purpose later on. I know that there's been quite a few hockey events there. Like I mentioned last time, I've watched quite a bit of hockey. I think I'll be going to it, the World Champs, whenever that is. What's your opinion on the whole sort of infrastructure side of the Olympics?
I think it's pretty fascinating. I mean, let's talk about Barcelona. So part of Barcelona 92 was the regeneration of the marina, which is obviously, I've been there since. I was there last year, actually, and beautiful beaches. And that is something that defines Barcelona as a city now. But at the same time, you've got the flip side of local citizens, when I was there at the time, saying, look, we're getting too much tourism. We can't live here because everyone's buying flats maybe to Airbnb. We can't physically sustain anything. I think infrastructure is a really interesting point. If we look at Athens 2004, quite a lot of writers and authors kind of indicate maybe that was the trouble. That was the start of the trouble Greece got in. You look at the main stadium there and it is the definition of a white elephant. It is run down. It's just tragic. There are a lot of stories of white elephants, and it's really that, I think it comes back to building it into the legacy and really ensuring that that's going to get used after. Again, you look at Delhi, you look at the problems they had getting the city ready, let alone trying to benefit from it after. Yeah, it is really interesting.
Well, that falls under the same bracket as Italia 90, when all the financial problems hit a load of clubs throughout the country sort of later on the decade, because of these giant stadiums that no one could really afford and didn't really know where the money was coming from to adequately fund those. Yeah, it is interesting. I'm still hopeful that Olympic Park will get a lot of usage, but it's just, there's so much really great stuff there. It's just a shame it's not being used all the time. Anyway, we'll jump a little bit further on. I think we've already sort of addressed the fact that perhaps you don't think legacies have been necessarily as successful as they're portrayed to be in the prior to the event. What barriers are there to youth engagement and creating successful legacies from large events?
I think obviously quite a lot of the time mega events are used as a bit of a soft power tool, which is fine and sometimes needs to be used. We look at recent kind of hosts of mega events, so Rio, we look at Germany 2006, around Germany using that as a way to change particularly Western Europe's perspective of Germany and the fan zones. I think it really has to tie in to the current sport development strategy of the country, if I'm honest. And quite a lot of that has to be the lasting, well, so what after? Does it mean that we can use the stadium as a bit of a high performance centre for local kids? Does it mean we've got a pathway in place that we can pick the best from the schools and they can get accessible training in terms of cost, in terms of travel getting there? How do we support families if they've got a particularly talented athlete in their midst that perhaps needs financial backing. It's a culmination of things, but also how do we also use, I guess, a city to, sorry, the entire city to benefit from a mega event, for instance, transport. Do we really must kind of factor that into the lasting legacy? If the athlete village is a thing, how do we make that affordable homes after, and not just go to the highest bidder to address maybe some of the more social issues a country might have? So yeah, there's a lot of factors that go in, I guess, into a successful legacy. And I'm not saying by any means anyone's cracked it, but some people have done really well and others less so well.
Okay, so I'm going to just reiterate just so I understand. The sort of one of the big barriers is being able to knit everyone together to sort of follow the same trajectory to a post-Olympic legacy. I'm going to keep saying Olympics. You know, I don't really mean Olympic. I just mean mega sporting event, but I'm just going to keep saying Olympic. So essentially, the big challenge is getting everyone to knit together cohesively to be able to get that vision to play through into the future. So you may have had one bracket just assuming, you know, the legacy would be sorted in X way and another in Y way. That I'm going down the right path with that thinking.
Yeah, and I'd just pick up on that point, Tim, getting everyone bought in, but also on a local level, if we think about sport development, mega events happen every four, however many years. So in the meantime, you've got people delivering sport on a day-to-day basis. How are you really going to sell the benefits of a mega event to them and get them to really get behind? Because essentially, they're the ones that are going to deliver particularly your sport legacy on the ground. How do you show them real benefit in the event coming? Not only that it will be a great spectacle, but how will it help them perhaps financially and build their club or their organisation? How can different stakeholders support their work? Because that really is key. After, say, the Olympics has moved on, after that kind of touring circus has gone, what is left? And is it rooted in the city that it was there briefly over the summer, for instance?
This is really difficult. I struggle to get my hand around this stuff, which is probably why I thought physiology was a better route to go down. Just a couple more things. I appreciate that you have to tread a little bit lightly around this next question, so just say whatever you like. But can the Commonwealth Games, obviously that's in Birmingham 2022, hope to have a greater legacy than the Olympics, even at just a local level across the West Midlands?
What a loaded question. So in terms of that, I mean, partly the reason Birmingham got it was because we already had the infrastructure in place in terms of where we could host other events. I know there's issues around we're using the Velodrome in London. Hey, the local council is doing the best with the money it gets. I think there is definitely an opportunity. And I think if everyone gets on board and is on the same page, we can definitely create that kind of that flashpoint in time for something more meaningful. I think it ties in quite well with current policy, maybe around what the combined authorities is doing transport wise in the area, and speeds up that agenda, as well as I know HS2 will happen after, but again keeping the momentum on that. I'm an optimist. I will always welcome a focus on Birmingham. I think if anything, hopefully it will dispel a little, you know, kind of coming to uni here, it may dispel some of the kind of particularly UK held views of the city, and propel it maybe into a bit more of a, we are the second city, sorry Manchester, but we are. So there's definitely opportunity there, but it has to be done in the right way. And I think one of the key parts is to get local organisations involved and get them to see the benefit, but also getting local people. You have to remember, Birmingham, we've got the Commonwealth Games, but quite a lot of citizens here are kind of questioning why, when last summer we couldn't get our bins delivered because local services were at such a strain. So yeah, there's an opportunity here to really kind of use 2022 as a way to kind of unite the city, I feel personally, and I can only speak from my perspective.
And even from my perspective, I'm going to throw my own 50 pence on this. Birmingham is a brilliant city. I stayed there for 5 years and I stayed there for a reason. And, you know, even in the time I was there, it went from like a good city. I'd completely regenerated in areas. You know, it was unrecognisable. You've got Grand Central now, which was used to be Birmingham New Street. And, well, still technically is, but old Birmingham New Street was horrible. You've got the mailbox and all that sort of area. So certainly in the centre of Birmingham, there has been a lot of change. So all those people who have those views that Birmingham is a bit rubbish, to come up with a word, are just, they're wrong, A, and they need to go back there because it has changed a lot. There's lots of good eclectic things to do up there. And I think shining a light on Birmingham in the right way is a really powerful tool that the Commonwealth Games can use. And, you know, it's a really interesting place to live. It's got so much wonderful going on for it. Let's, you know, use that to spark a little bit of regeneration up there, even more so than there is currently. And I know I live and work in London, but I'm very conscious of the fact that people with HS2 are going to get drained even more into London because it will become easier to get down there. But I'm like, why not the other way? Why won't people move up to Birmingham? Because it's as nice. It's easy enough to walk around. Yeah, do it. I love it. It was great. So hopefully you and your gang and all the other gangs that are out there doing the stuff you're going to be doing pre-Commonwealth Games can really, you know, fly the flag for Birmingham, because I loved it out there and it's a brilliant city. Right. This is, if you thought the last one was loaded, you know what's coming. This is a bit more loaded. Feel free to be as pragmatic as you like. But I thought just to make it interesting. If you were dropped in as Minister for Sport tomorrow with the ability to enforce 3 unopposed policies, feel free to do just 1 or 2. What would you change in the UK in a sporting sense?
I think for me personally, around the curriculum, the sports curriculum in schools, and giving more, I think we've heard the head teachers off the last budget, but give schools more money, please. We talk about a health crisis happening, but that's where you're going to get kids at an early age. There's no point trying to do an intervention, like you say, Weight Watchers 20 years time. We have to make it a lifelong habit. And to do that, we have to empower those that kind of engage kids. We have to, one, make teaching sustainable, I guess. I don't know if this is part of my sports remit, but we have to make teaching a sustainable job, as opposed to being trained and teachers being not fully supported and dropping out. And PE teachers have to have resources, and they have to have, I guess, the knowledge to really kind of create that broadened sports curriculum, as well as, I guess, getting young people to maybe see the opportunities within sport and how varied they can be. It can be, like we said, you've gone into physiology, you could have someone go into sports media, you could have someone go into the kind of like what I do, sport for development. There's a complete myriad of jobs there. So I guess schools would be one, and supporting them effectively with what sport can deliver. Personally, and I think something that Birmingham really struggles from is loads of youth centres have shut down over the past couple of years, and that creates a real vacuum in terms of where young people meet, and young people are often ostracised for hanging around in groups. That's because they've got nowhere to hang about. So again, I don't know if it falls under my remit, but giving money back to public services, it has to. I mean, half the problem we're having in London, knife crime, all stems from lack of resource in society. If we don't make people feel valued, of course they'll drop out, of course they'll offend and they'll re-offend. There has to be meeting points where people can feel like they belong. And if that's in sport, great. But if that's creatively, if that's maybe politically, they have to feel needed and they have to,
Those are some really good answers. I'm in total agreement. I'm just too good at agreeing with what people say. I should probably fight back a bit more. But
you're not a Piers Morgan.
I'm not a Piers Morgan. But then, you know, I don't. No, I'm just going to say it. I think I've said before on the podcast that PE teachers often throughout my school, they were some of the best teachers that I had, and really sort of inspired me into doing stuff to do with sport. I know not directly necessarily. I was more interested in science and sciencey stuff to begin with, but then sort of fell into it, and it was a very happy accident. I wouldn't be doing anything like the stuff I'm doing, like working at the pinnacle of the NHS in one of the biggest hospitals in London, doing heart stuff. Even a year ago, I would have thought that was a complete joke, so let alone the fact that I'm doing it now is a complete accident. And that's all because of the passion that I have for the human body, and that wouldn't be there without sport. Anyway, that was a really interesting chat, UV. There was a lot of stuff in there that I just had absolutely no idea about, and I really, really enjoyed it. I hope you had a little bit of fun too. I'm quite keen to get you on a couple of times in the future when we have these sort of discussions, because socially we're not very good as a trio, me, Jack and Chris. I mean, we're obviously great lads, but we're not very good at the social side of sport. We often talk about sport and the events specifically as they're happening, like results of them, our opinions on dramas and misdemeanors and all that sort of thing. But like, I think it'd be quite fun to get you in a few times in the future. So I'm assuming you're going to be happy to do that when you can.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Lovely. Right, so take that as read that you're going to be hearing from Evie again in the future. Anyway, that's it from us. If you have any questions for us or Evie specifically, be nice. What's your Twitter handle, Evie?
It is at Harrison Evie.
You happy for people to get in touch on there?
Yeah, love a Twitter debate. Let's do it.
Anyway, it's too late now if you didn't want to give that one out. Yeah, and otherwise we're at dugout_debate, but I'm guessing if you're here, you probably already know that. Smash a cheeky retweet if you like it, and that sort of thing. We want to get this out to as many people as we can. Anyway, thank you very much, Evie.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.